It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome back to Money for Lunch. I sometimes forget that I can't eat right before I go on the show, but that's what I was doing. Literally having lunch here on Money for Lunch. All right, so for the last few days, I've been reading a tip, a strategy, if you will, 13 things mentally strong people don't do. This can be found at businessinsider.com. I think we probably need to do is put it up on moneyforlunch.com. But anyway, so they list 13 things that mentally strong people just don't do or don't get hung up on. One of them is they don't focus on things they can't control. Instead, they focus on what they can do, right? So rather than focusing on managing your anxiety, you try controlling your environment. Shifting your focus off the things you can't control can create an increased happiness, less stress, better relationship, new opportunities, and more success. Yeah. So we're going to get Amy to post this on Facebook someplace, and then you guys can have it. Not on Facebook. What am I talking about? Getting it on Money for Lunch. You'll have the 13 things mentally strong people don't do. So, all right, let's get this party started. my first guest today, and I apologize to my guest right off the bat because it looks like I've got a little bit of a quandary, if you will. We have two guests coming up, and Dr. Steve G. Jones is going to come on first, and then we're going to have Dr. Marlene Boas. So I apologize for the confusion there, Dr. Marlene. But my first guest is Dr. Steve G. Jones. Dr. Steve G. Jones is one of our regular contributors, and he is the guy that celebrities and some of the celebrity business people go to when they need help dealing with stuff that they're having problems with. Dr. Steve G. Jones has been a hypnotist, a certified hypnotherapist since the 1980s. And as I mentioned earlier, one of our regular contributors, Dr. Steve G. Jones, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Well, thanks, Bert. Good to be here.
Well, good to have you here. I know that you're out and about. You're in New York?
I'm all around. I'm like a globetrotter.
Where in the world is Dr. Steve?
There you go. It's a new board game for kids.
There you go.
How
it's the new game. Oh, man, I'm excited. We're getting ready to crush the holidays and get some downtime. So we're all very excited here. And I'm excited because I wanted to talk to you specifically about this thing that I just read off there in the intro about the things that we control and things that we cannot control. So you up to play that game?
I am. Let's do that one. Is that a board game too?
That's a board game too. It's a game that unfortunately a lot of us play all the time.
Yep, I'm afraid so. You know, I heard a saying one time that I thought was very helpful. They said if you're sensitive, you can either pad everything in the world or you can wear slippers.
If you're sensitive, you can pad everything in the world or wear slippers.
Yeah, and the meaning is, you know, if you feel like in this case your feet are sensitive, you have to walk around and have everything soft for you, and so you can go around the world making everything soft. You can fix this, fix that, make that something that you like, or you can work on yourself, and that's going to give you something very powerful because now in any situation you're prepared to deal with it.
I think that, I like that. First of all, you know, we as humans, sometimes we get into this thing where we try to control too much, or we become the victim of things we cannot control. And in either of those scenarios, it's not healthy. But I wanted to talk to you about how do you go about changing your mindset from a victor mentality, from a victim mentality to one of the victor mentality. You know, you work with a lot of people. You have a really intimate knowledge of how the brain works and how people think. And you must see this victim mentality quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely. You know, just like I was talking about with the slippers, you know, you can go around saying, oh, they did this to me, they did that to me, you know, woe is me. That's productive up to a point, but really the only thing it produces is just, you know, you're getting some attention and people feeling sorry for you and things like that. When you really take control of your life, then you accept a lot of things the way they are, a lot of people the way they are. You let go of attempting to change everyone and change the entire world, and you realize that, you know, as silly as it sounds and as cliche as it sounds, change comes from within. And once Yes. you change, then everything around you seems to change. It's not changing. It's just your perception that's changing.
Yes, absolutely. And that's really the most important thing that needs to be changed, is that perception, that inner thinking. We've seen people who come from very tragic, very poor circumstances. They overcome it all and they become, quote, successful, right? And we've seen people who have been given everything in life. Their parents are connected. They went to the best schools. They have every opportunity, and they can't manage their way out of the paper bag. And I want your opinion on this. The only difference is that mental perception, that the way they see things.
Yeah, I mean, if you – and there's a great book, and you've probably read it, The Millionaire Next Door. I think it was written in 1996, so a little outdated now. But it's still got some so a lot of the numbers are off. You know, the price they say a standard mortgage would be, and yearly salaries and things like that. The numbers are pretty far off because they haven't been adjusted for inflation. But the gist is still there. And there's a whole chapter on outpatient therapy that parents give to their kids. And they don't arm them for making money in the world because they had it so rough. So we have a parent who in one generation became wealthy through becoming a doctor, lawyer, business person, what have you. They don't want their kids to suffer. So they give their kids everything. And what happens? The kids suffer because they don't learn the skills how to do that themselves. You know, we look at some of the more clever families, clever in a good way, and we see them passing on those skills. You know, like Warren Buffett had decided not to give his kids or grandkids a whole lot, and that teaches them the idea that, hey, you've got to go find your passion, develop it, and do your thing, and that's how you'll make your money.
I like that. You know, I had the pleasure of spending a couple of days with Evander Holyfield, and I asked him that question. I said, Evander, you know, one of the reasons that I think you're successful is because you had a struggle for everything. You know, you didn't come from a privileged background with lots of money. You know, he was, you know, maybe slightly above poverty. He had for him to go to the boxing ring to train, or the boxing gym to train, was an hour one way by bus, that kind of stuff. And I asked him, you know, now that you're wealthy, you're connected, your kids have your name, do you think that's going to help them or hurt them? And his answer was really cute. He talked about his mama. He's from the South. And so he talked about, you know, my mama did this and my mama did that. And what I learned from all this is that it's about your mama. It's about the people you have at home that are going to help you or break you, right? So back to what you're talking about, Steve, about the parents. We see this all the time. We've seen, and I love the example you gave, parents who are today successful are not, and they're successful because they struggled and they achieved certain strengths, but they're not teaching that on to their kids, and they're making their kids weak and selfish and for lack of better terms, you know, sniveling little cowards.
Yeah, and they cripple them. They don't realize that they're setting themselves, they're setting their kids up for a life of unhappiness. Now, this doesn't always happen, but yeah, that's the idea. And the fascinating thing here is that the parents have the best intentions for the kids. They love
yes.
their children so much that they don't want them to suffer. Not realizing, and we seem to be getting on to parents here, but any of us can do this to ourselves as well to make it universally useful here. But they do it out of love. What they don't realize is those things are not just giving a kid anything they want. That kind of action is not something that's going to arm them for what my dad used to call the real world. I used to hate when he said that. Get ready for the real world, but it's true. The real world is one where you don't have this constant flow from mommy and daddy, and you've got to stand on your own.
Yes. Well, and here's the deal. You and I get to hang out with, you know, some very successful people, some people who are quote unquote celebrities. One of the things that I had the pleasure of doing is I, you know, about once or twice a year, I go hang out with former Governor Schwarzenegger, and he talks about the fact that strength does not come from winning. And at first, when he told me that, I was like, what? And then he goes on to say, he says, you know, your struggles are the things that develop your strengths. When you go through hardships and decide not to surrender, that is where your strength comes from. And that totally makes sense,
yeah.
Especially when you apply it in this scenario here where these kids are winning, quote, they're being given everything, but they're not having to struggle, so therefore they have no inner strength. They don't know how to deal with adversity. They don't know how to deal with obstacles. And it's just amazing to me it's almost an oxymoron. It seems like the fact that you're helping your kids achieve all this stuff would make them somehow better, faster, but it's not. They're missing that developed inner strength.
Absolutely. If victory for them means it's something that comes with the aid of somebody else much stronger, then that's always what it's going to mean. Now I can say that many of the victories in my life have been with the help of other people. It's been a group
yeah.
effort, but it's never been a total reliance upon them. It's always, I have my clearly defined job to do in this situation, and so do you, and so do they, and we're all doing our job the best we can, and we're going to have a victory, which is a lot different from saying, hey, if I just sit down here and fall down and don't do anything, someone's going to take care of it. They're going to do my part and their part, and we're still going to win.
Absolutely, absolutely. I love that. And on that, we're going to end. I appreciate you stopping by. I know you're on a tight schedule today. And Dr. Steve G. Jones, I want you to have some happy holidays as you travel around. And looking forward to meeting with you soon, my friend.
Well, thank you, Bert. Happy holidays to you, too, and I'll see you soon.
All righty. Good stuff there from Dr. Steve G. Jones. He's our resident hypnotherapist. Steve G. Jones has been a clinical hypnotherapist, like I said, since the 1980s. He's authored over 22 books. You can find out more about Steve and his amazing audios. He's stevegjones.com holds the world's largest audio library of different hypnotherapy strategies, hypnotherapy audios to help you with anything that you might need, inner strength. Things like loving exercise, things like accomplishing your goals, they're all there. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
My name is Peter Shankman, and I have a new book coming out called Zombie Loyalists, Using Great Service to Create Rabid Fans. You ever go to a restaurant and you eat there and they really like you and you go back a lot and they treat you really well and they buy you a free drink and you bring friends and all you want to do is go to that place and that's the restaurant you go to all the time? You're a zombie loyalist for that restaurant. In my new book, I'm going to show you how to create zombie loyalists for your business, whatever kind of business that is. You're going to create customers who are so in love with you. They want to do your PR, they want to do your marketing, and they want to do your advertising for you. Remember, when you tell the world how awesome you are, no one believes you. But when someone else tells the world how awesome you are, everyone believes it. I'm going to show you how to be awesome to those customers so they bring you more and more customers and driving your revenue through the roof. Sales are going to explode. Customers are going to explode. Everyone is going to love you. This book will change what you think about your customers, how you treat them, and how you do business. It's going to be a wild ride. Everyone loves zombies. Buckle up.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Dr. Marlene Boas. Dr. Marlene Boas is a board-certified coach, consultant, and collaborative professional who spent her career helping people live more satisfying, fulfilling, and happier lives. Marlene has an extensive experience in the profit as well as the nonprofit arena, working with individuals, executives, and teams to help them clarify their aspirations and achieve their goals. You can find out more about Dr. Marlene at MarleneBoas, BOAS.com. Dr. Marlene Boas, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. I'm glad you're here. Let's talk about this. I want to talk about how to achieve clarity for your goals, because to me, and I want your opinion on this, it's very difficult to achieve anything without clarity. Clarity seems to be very important. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when we talk about clarity, for me, things are really complex. And when we're establishing our goals, one of the things that I find most important is that they're anchored to your values. So really getting clarity on your values and really taking time to reflect on that before you start establishing your goals is really important.
All right, so let's talk about that. When you say goals must be anchored directly to your values, what do you mean by that? What's the downside if they're not?
Well, if they're not, you don't have the internal intrinsic motivation that you need to achieve them. So whenever we're establishing our goals, we want to think about what's really important to us. And so if you sit and think, what do you value in life? A lot of us can just come up with some words quickly. But when you drill down and keep going down to why is that important, and really become much more descriptive, it becomes more emotional. And once it's tied to our emotions and we really understand what we value, then the goals kind of fall into place and it's easier to achieve them. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Matter of fact, that makes a lot of sense, because we've all seen people who say, well, you know, I want to lose weight. But maybe it's not really, you know, maybe they're saying that because that's what they think they should be saying, right? But it's not really something that they really value. So they don't lose the weight.
Right, so let's take that one.
Okay.
That's a great example. So let's say I want to lose weight. Okay. So then you could maybe drill down. Well, I want to be, you know, in better shape. I want to look better in my clothes. Well, drill down deeper. As I get older, I want to be able to stay active. You know, maybe you look around and you see people who haven't taken good care of themselves. And then you drill down even deeper and go, you know, when my children grow up and they have grandchildren, I want to make sure that I'm active and can be with them, and maintaining a healthy weight is a part of that. And so as you drill down, it gets deeper, and it gets deeper into your heart and your soul, and it's much more meaningful. And so that's what I say about really anchoring it to your values.
Yes, absolutely. I think that right there is a nice takeaway. If you're struggling to achieve goals in your life, maybe they're not your goals. Maybe they're not, as you say, they're not, you know, values that are directly anchored to you. They're not integrated in your life. Just, you know, we all want to have a certain level of financial security. We all want a certain level of health. and those are all variable, right? They're all subjective. So if you're out there chasing a bunch of money, but money doesn't necessarily turn you on, maybe not that much money, right? Maybe you just, right. Maybe what you value is having, peace and time with the family more than anything else, then maybe money at this time is not important to you. It could change later on, but I like this thing about integrating your values and that directly, and by integrating your values, but by knowing what your values are, that's going to help you achieve your goals.
That's right. And you bring up a really good point in that, you know, the financial aspect or the work aspect or the physical aspect is not a discrete area. Our lives are complex and everything is integrated. So let's say you want to go for, you know, I want to have $5 million by the time I'm 50, you know, and that's a goal you set. But you've got to look at the other parts of your life and how, if you are just dead set on that and disregard the others, how it will affect the other parts of your life. So I look at it, you know, as life kind of as a mobile hanging from the ceiling. And if it's well balanced, you know, it's nice. But you move one part and everything moves. So when you're establishing your goals, you've got to look at the whole, all the domains of your life and move them together as a unit, because one piece will affect the others.
Yes. No, I totally like that. I like the idea of looking at your goals as this mobile up in, you know, on top of the ceiling floating around there. And you're right. You start messing with one, they all start to react. And so I think that's a great analogy, a great vision too. To me, you know, we talked about this in the very beginning of the show, is this clarity, how important it is to be clear. And this goes back to the first thing we talked about, which is having these goals directly anchored to your value. And I think that once you know what your values are, that will help you with your clarity. Because again, if you're frustrated, if you don't know what your steps are, that really comes from unclear. And that is something I've discovered from hitting my head against the wall so many times, is once I'm clear about something, man, it's easy, right? But if you're unclear,
right.
Something's happening. That unclarity, that uncertainty is probably a signal that that there's something maybe amiss, right? That there may be a mismatch in values, and therefore that's why you're unclear. I don't know. But bottom line
right.
is, if you're uncertain, unclear, you're going to be stumbling.
Yeah, you're going to be spinning your wheels. And that's the other thing is, sometimes we can feel sort of the cloudiness and the lack of clarity, but we can't find our way out of it. And that's like where coaching comes in, because you have somebody challenging you. And when you're making you operate on your own assumptions, and sometimes you don't even know they're assumptions. Like you were talking with your previous guest, your perceptions are your perceptions, and sometimes you don't even know that they're in some way through a lens that could be broadened or opened. So even with your values, I was working once with a woman, and she was so hard on herself because she hadn't achieved a graduate degree. And through our work together, she discovered that that was never one of her values. That was one of her mother's values, who had grown up during sort of, you know, women's liberation time, and her mother wanted her daughter to do that. And when she understood that she'd been carrying that around for 50 years and it wasn't her value, all of a sudden she could let it go and focus her energy on something that was important to her for her life. So that clarity helps sometimes when you have someone you trust who can challenge you to look deeper and to really go down and figure out what's in your heart, soul, and then establish a vision around that.
Yes. No, I think that's what a great story. I think a lot of us can relate to that. A lot of us are wondering, you know, why we're having a hard time here or there. And it's because we are living a value that isn't ours. We're holding on to a value that was given to mm-hmm. us by our parents. And I've always enjoyed the story of, of the little girl who's watching her mother. I think she's cooking fish, or no, she's cooking something. I think it's a meatloaf or something, or she's cooking. Anyway, to make this story move forward, she's cooking, let's say, a meat, and she cuts the meat off each end of the roast before putting it in there and before putting it in to cook. And the daughter says to the mom, why do you cut the ends off? And the mother says, well, you know, I don't know, but that's the way mom always did it. And so she asks grandma, why do you cut the ends off the roast? And she goes, oh, well, because back then the only way we could get the roast to fit into the only pan they had was to cut the ends off. And boom, now we see that
Great. Sometimes
we have these values, these beliefs that really have nothing to do with our reality. And to me, that was great. You know, it's kind of a story there how we pick beliefs. We don't check why we believe them.
Yeah, that's a great story. And so many things that we do, we go, and so much of life is on automatic pilot. And we don't even think about what we're doing or what we're thinking. We don't have this metacognition to really stop and think about what we're thinking about. And then to find out what our values are, life is changing so quickly, and we get so caught up in it that we don't take time to really reflect on ourselves. And when we get to the end of our lives, or what are our long-term goals, or how we want to be as a human being. And so some really quiet, contemplative time to think about what's important to you on a very deep level and what kind of human you want to be, then all those other goals will fall into place nicely.
Yes. No, I like that. I like that so much. All right. Let's talk about this. You use this strategy. You call it wordsmith your goals. Talk about this.
Yeah.
What do you mean by wordsmithing your goals?
Well, once you do your sort of values clarification and you know what your where you want to go, where you are, where you want to go, I'm a wordsmith. Words matter. And so as you try to articulate your goals and to represent your values, taking the time to really wordsmith it and doing it in a way that someone looks at it, it's sort of like, you know, you mentioned I work a lot with nonprofits when they do their mission and vision statements. It takes a long time to get those to really show what the organization is about, and inherited there are some goals. And so if we do that personally and really take the time to be thoughtful about it, once again, that anchors it, which then feeds the motivation to achieve it. And so you have to revisit it, and you have to refine it over time. But if you're always wordsmithing it, you're always refining it and getting it closer and closer to where you want it to be. And words matter.
Oh, you know what? It's so true. I mean, words have a huge impact on how we feel, right? You can be really pissed off, angry. You could be frustrated. You could be a little irked. And these are all little different, filters to describe how you feel. And,
right.
And the more filters, the more words, as you said, as you wordsmith, you know, then you have more to choose from. Because you don't always have to be really pissed off or angry. You could be a little bothered by it.
Exactly. And once you have a broad vocabulary, it really, really helps you hone in on what it's about. Because that broad vocabulary, if you have a poverty of speech and you can only have a couple words to choose from, it's not going to be that deep and that well integrated into you or that descriptive.
Yeah.
And I like the whole idea of a very descriptive imagining if success was inevitable, what would it look like, what would it feel like, and really taking some time to visualize that. That also helps integrate and provide energy for motivation and motivation.
Yes, I like that. All right, final question for you is, when you're working with people and you know, maybe you're working on your own goals, whatever it is, how do you know if you're on the right trajectory? How do you measure that?
You know, that is just so important. And it's something when you start out and you're establishing your goals is, how am I going to know if I'm making progress? And so whatever criteria you're going to use, you have to establish that in the beginning, not like when you're halfway down. So, you know, let's say we'll go back to the losing weight. what is it going to be? Is it going to go, are you going to make a chart of how many pounds you lose, or are you going to make a chart of how much you exercise or what you eat or all of the above? But if you're going to have a goal, how are you going to evaluate that you're making progress? You know, and that happens in business and nonprofits everywhere. So many people set out to do something, but don't ever think about how they'll know if they're on the right path. And they can spend time, money, energy walking down a path, and then they get there and go, oops. So you have to start out at the beginning, and that's another place to be very thoughtful and to to really think about how will I know. And if it's anchored to the value, that may influence it rather than just some number goal.
Absolutely. All right. I said that was going to be my final question, but I lied a little bit in the sense that I want to talk about this because I think that this is one of the things that as humans do poorly, and that is we have been taught by society, by our peers, by our parents at home, not to celebrate ourselves, not to celebrate our successes, to to quote this false sense of humility. You know, so when we achieve something, and people say, wow, you know, you did a great job. Oh, thank you. It's not that big of a deal. And we're now using these words to downplay instead of celebrate our accomplishments. And I think that we do this to ourselves, and then we wonder why we have this unfulfilled life when, you know, we dare not celebrate our smallest or our biggest accomplishments. Talk about that.
You know, that's such a good point, and especially, you know, with children and with ourselves. We do need to celebrate. Now, it has to be for something that is truly important, and it can't just be, oh, good job for every little thing. And the way to do that is to get very specific. If you're complimenting someone, get specific about what it is. Maybe it's some interaction, or maybe they achieve something. But not just great on the achievement of the goal, but recognize what step or what little piece did it and get specific about it. And even ourselves, we can celebrate our small successes, and we have to recognize what little obstacle or what challenge we met or was successful at, because then that breeds more success. So I agree with you. We can't be pervasive, just everything's great. But when we force ourselves to be specific and talk very specifically about what happened well, that gives it a lot more credence and a lot more strength.
I love that. And we're going to end on that note. Dr. Boas, I'd love to bring you back and talk more about everything that we just talked about. It's been an absolute blast having you on the show. Bring it back, talk more about clarity and reaching our goals. Dr. Marlene Boas, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy to be here.
Oh, man. All right, guys. Good stuff there from Dr. Marlene Boas. You can find out more about Marlene at MarleneBoas.com. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then when we come back, Vicky Koshuchenko. I may or may not be speaking Russian. And when I say that, I don't know. I think I might end up, straining my lips. Either way, we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we're back. And my next guest is being so generous as I wrestle with her name. Vicky Koshuchenko is a seasoned HR leader with over 20 years of experience across various industries and organizations. She's an HR generalist, HR system specialist, and training director in hospitality and media organizations, an HR director and HR VP for leading food service company, and the head of HR for a healthcare organization. She is president and CEO of DLK Consulting Group, as HR services and coaching practice she founded in 2015, and she divides her practice into two areas: support for an organization and leaders and guidance for individuals, or entering the professional individuals in or entering the professional workplace. Yeah, okay. Her practice focuses on providing leadership coaching to mid-level and senior leaders in organizations of various sizes and types, as well as career coaching to the undergrad students, graduate students, and early career professionals. Vicky Kosyushenko, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert. Glad to be here.
You bet. The VLK Consulting Group is so much easier than Kosyushenko.
It is, and that's why I chose that instead of going with Kosyushenko Consulting Group.
After a while, it rolls off the tip of the tongue. It's just, it's like anything else. You just got to get used to it.
That's right. I've been practicing for over 4 years. I still mostly get it right.
I like that. Okay. All right. So let's talk about, give me a little bit about your background. Here you are. You obviously have a background as an HR journalist. So how do you go from HR generalist to coaching? Talk a little bit about your journey there.
Sure, absolutely. So as you mentioned in your intro, I have been in human resources for over 20 years now. I started out with a degree in hospitality management, and when I came out of my degree program, I had a specialty in human resources. That was my concentration, so I knew that was the field that I was likely to jump into, and I did. And as I spent my time in hospitality organizations and then took a slight detour into media and entertainment for a while and then came back and went into food service and then ultimately into healthcare, there was a constant theme. So even though I was consistently providing support and guidance and leadership around, sticky employment relations issues and benefits and compensation and training and development and, just managing HR practices across organizations, inevitably, a lot of those things just kept coming back to leadership. And how did individuals who were in leadership roles develop their own capabilities? How did they build their capacity? How did they engage with their teams and with the organization? And that led me down the coaching path. And the coaching path for me is it fits very nicely with my personality, my behavioral style, because I love helping people figure out what is meaningful and purposeful to them. And to me, that's what coaching is really about. It's about an individual inside an organization or getting ready to join an organization really understanding themselves and doing a lot of self-assessment and evaluation, spending time understanding what your behavioral style is, what your cultural fit might be, what your values and your own goals are, and then finding the right organization and or the right role that allows you to really utilize all of those capabilities in a nice way. So that really led me into coaching individuals inside organizations around that kind of framework, and did that simultaneously with my HR leadership roles over time, and then ultimately decided it was time to really get out on my own and be able to focus in on that. So as you mentioned, I focus in my consulting practice on two areas. I still provide the HR services and the consulting to small and mid-sized businesses who often don't have their own HR team in place, or they can't really spend a lot of time and money thinking about the more comprehensive and strategic aspects of HR. But then I've got another part of my business that really focuses on leadership coaching for mid-level and senior-level professionals, and then career coaching, which is really centered on those folks who are up-and-coming professionals. So they're getting ready to graduate from college, or they're in MBA or master's level programs. Sometimes they're law school students, or they're even out and in their organizations and have been for a year or two. And they're really just trying to settle, right? Trying to figure out what's my place here? Am I in the right organization? Have I figured it all out? And so that's where I kind of come in and help.
Let me ask you this, with your background and everything, is now the worst time or the best time to be looking for a job, or does it make no difference?
Time of year, it's a great time. And I think that's because people tend to start to slow down a little bit and take a little bit of a break at the end of the year. It tends to be a period of self-reflection for a lot of people. Obviously, a lot of us go into the new year and make New Year's resolutions and really kind of look back over the prior year. For me, I find that to be a really refreshing and interesting opportunity to kind of search for what else might be out there for somebody. So I think from that standpoint, the time of year is a great time to be looking for a job as an individual. I also think organizationally, organizations are starting to, especially if they're on a calendar year for their fiscal year, they're really starting to put jobs out there right now, and you'll see more postings and, you know, you'll see recruiters making more phone calls because their clients are really ramping up for the new year and know that their budgets are going to be able to support new headcount. So from that standpoint, I think it's great.
You know, it's I would call it exciting to hear that, because I know a lot of people tend to push off, you know, job search during the holidays, and here you guys have it from an insider that it's a great time, you know, to be out there, because you're right. A lot of people are slowing down, and in a lot of cases, they may be willing to take a phone call because maybe their workload has slowed down a little bit. So maybe you can get a hold of them today where, you know, come January, back to the grind kind of a thing, you'll never get a hold of them.
Right, right. And I think the other interesting thing that goes on is that the end of year tends to be a really busy period for some organizations, right? You're doing year-end closeout. You're kind of reflecting back on the year, and people tend to sometimes be very focused as they finish out their year from a work standpoint.
Right.
Depending on how engaged you are within your organization and how comfortable and happy you are with the role and the company you're working for, if this time of year does tend to get really busy for you from a recruiter standpoint or another organization that's out there looking for candidates, this can be the perfect time for the quote-unquote what I'll call right call on the wrong day, right? So
right.
You know, somebody calls and says, hey, I've got an opportunity out there, and you go, oh, well, you know, today's been a really tough day or tough week or tough month for me and my organization. Maybe it is time for me to take a look out there.
No, I like that. I like that. All right, let's talk about this. People are out there, let's say, looking for a transition, looking for their first job, I don't know, how important is it for them to step out of their comfort zone?
Oh, I think that's incredibly important. I think it's a requirement, really, when you are in transition or you're looking for your first job, because we all are so used to falling back on what we know and staying within our comfort zone because it's easy, it's comfortable, it's something that, you know, doesn't require a ton of effort, and we all get caught up in so many other things in our lives that effort sometimes seems a really hard thing to take on. But, you know, I think if you really want to find the right thing for you, it takes a lot of reflection. It takes a lot of evaluation of your own interests, how you're currently fulfilling your, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. Are you meeting your needs and meeting your desires? And that is uncomfortable work to do. So stepping out of your comfort zone on that standpoint, I think, is important. I think equally, getting out there and kind of looking at things differently, right? So thinking about, well, I'm in this type of organization or I'm in this type of role. If you stay within that bubble and you say, well, the only work I can do is within the same type of organization or industry or the same type of role, you are limiting yourself so much. There are so many opportunities out there, so many different great organizations to work for. I think it's a great shame when folks don't kind of think a little differently about what they do and how they do it and explore.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think the best thing, whether you're an old fogey or a recent graduate, getting comfortable with being uncomfortable really should be our mantra, because that's where all the growth comes from. That's where all the juice comes from. And it doesn't have to be crazy out of your comfort zone. It's like a lot of things. It's a little bit at a time. Most of us were not able to jump on a bike and start riding it immediately. Most of us had coaches, meaning somebody helped us. We had training wheels. We had all these little baby steps before we took those training wheels off and started riding our bikes all over the place.
Well, exactly, right? I mean, nobody comes to an organization or to a job perfect and,
right,
you know, exceptionally capable. So yeah, recognizing that about the people around you, I think, doesn't make it a little bit easier to step out of your own comfort zone. I think the other thing that's so important, Bert, is we're in this world now where change is just the norm, right? There is there's no role, there's no company, there's no environment that you're going to be in where you're not dealing with constant change. So if you're not comfortable dealing with change and you're not comfortable getting out of your comfort zone and thinking about things differently, trying new, you know, roles, new jobs, new projects, that kind of stuff, you're going to find yourself stagnant and potentially, you know, on the lower end of the performance rating scale at the end of the year.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Let's talk about this. One of the things that you wrote about is using your school's alumni network for, again, this is for somebody who's just, you know, I don't know if it's just for new college graduates. This alumni network really could be for anybody, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I use mine all the time. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I spend a fair amount of time talking to college students, but I also have a very strong alumni network myself through my undergrad and my grad school program, and then in talking to my peers, the number of people who get their perfect ideal job or even just their next job through their alumni network, their networks in general, but their alumni network is staggering. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I talk to somebody who says, yeah, you know, I just landed the perfect job. It's ideal. It's exactly where I want it to be. You know, how'd you get that? Oh, you know, somebody that I knew from the college I went to who connected me to somebody else who found the organizational contact for me. It happens all the time. And I think that's because in alumni networks, if you actually use them, you reach out to however it is that you can get to that alumni network. A lot of colleges and universities have an alumni database you can access through their website or through their alumni affairs office. And you use that, you can find people who are doing the things that you want to be doing or that you have interest in or in the geographic area that you'd like to move to. And those folks, when you make a connection and you say, hey, I am from the same school as you, they are often much more willing to spend more time talking to you than they might be to someone who's unknown. And so that's just a great door, right? It's a great door to open, and it can lead to some fantastic connections and ultimately, you know, whatever it is you're trying to accomplish.
Interesting how these alumni networks work, right? You and I may not have anything in common, but we happen to go to the same school, and all of a sudden that changes everything.
Exactly. It does. And I think the reason that it changes everything is because we have something in common that we can speak about. There's a common language, right? Having a common language with somebody, regardless if all other things are different, creates a connection. And it's the same concept as if you speak another language. Speaking another language opens doors for you that you wouldn't otherwise have open. And having a common alumni connection does the same thing, though in arguably different or, you know, other ways. But the opportunity that network presents, you know, it can be as random or as indirect as finding somebody on LinkedIn that went to the same school as you that you're interested in and just reaching out and making a LinkedIn connection that way and dropping that connection into the message. It can be as specific as making sure that you actively get to the next alumni event in your hometown and meeting some new people that you've never met before. I think it just creates those opportunities that you might not have elsewhere, and the language itself, it could be, you know, you sit and you have a conversation about you both took the same class 15 years apart, or, you know, you both contributed to the same fund campaign or whatever on campus because that's meaningful to you, or you both lived in the same dorm when you were freshmen. And those things just, they make a difference for people. They're personal connections.
Yeah, I like that. Let me ask you this. Speaking of personal connection, you advise people to stay away from texting when it comes to either, is it job hunting or connecting with a network or connecting with a possible interviewer? Talk about this the strategy of staying away from text messaging.
Sure. So, you know, I'm a little bit old school, I will say, and that I when I was in college, we were just getting into the computer and internet world, as it were, and texting certainly was a far off concept that I don't think anybody really had a lot of insight into at that point. In the last 5-8 years, it's exploded. It's such a common method of communication for so many of us. And, you know, the number of times I text my husband during the week to say, hey, can you bring home a gallon of milk? Or text the best friend just to say hi and check in on them. It's frequent, right? However, texting to me has a time and place, and the time and place is not when you're searching for a job. And I think that's because texting has a very informal feeling to it. Even to those that are used to it, have been doing it since before they can remember. The informality of it, I don't think aligns properly with a job search. A job search still has elements of formality to it. It's certainly meant to be a professional activity that needs to be undertaken with respect and with the appropriate meaning to it. And ultimately, texting can be less personal than it needs to be. And so regardless of whether you are, you know, trying to make a connection through a network or you're setting up an interview, I think that you have to be careful about texting. Now, I will say that I have worked with recruiters who use texting as a common mechanism to schedule interviews and connect with their candidates because it's an easy and simple and instant, in a lot of cases, way to confirm details. So I get that, and I'm not opposed to that in that kind of a sense. I just think that before you go ahead and send a text to somebody that you are interested in working with or working for or somehow getting connected to for the purposes of a job search, think about why you're doing it and you know, whether it has the right meaning and impact for what it is you're ultimately trying to accomplish.
Yes, and I think that this also goes back to matching the media with the message with the audience because, you know, you might be, what do you call it, if you were to text somebody who is, you know, say, really old school, really formal, very conservative, they may be completely offended. Mm-hmm. And especially, yeah. You know, you mentioned the informality of texting. I think that one of the things that one of the side effects of texting is that we you know, there are a bunch of kids out there that have lost the ability to write a complete sentence.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and forget capitalization and punctuation, right? I mean, it's just like, you know. It's acronyms and whatever, but so yeah, you could offend somebody by texting them. So you better, you know, I think you play it safe until you have the job. You need to find out what's going on, and I think that you err on the side of caution. Let me ask you this: I really want your input as an HR insider. Do you recommend? Let's say I filled out the application online, which is 99% of them are all doing this online application, right? Now, do you recommend trying to do a follow-up phone call, a physical drop-by? How aggressive should I be in connecting that, that HR person with my application? Let's say I'm perfect for the job. I have, you know, it just resonates with me. I know I could crush this position. What's your take? How aggressive should I be in making a face-to-face contact? Or not necessarily face-to-face, but physical contact of some type?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that depends on a number of things, right? And obviously, if you are applying to one job of 100 in a very large organization, call it, you know, a drugstore chain or a grocery store or something like that, where your application goes and who's going to be looking at that and ultimately making a decision about your qualifications may not be the local store that you're applying to. And that can sometimes mean that the time that you might spend in making a personal connection might not be as valuable as if you're applying at the, you know, local business down the street. And you do an online application, dropping in there and getting a chance to meet the owner and say, hey, I just completed this application online. I'm really interested in the job and what you do, and here's why. I think that that can be very impactful and can have meaning and help for you. So in some ways, it's, you know, it's the old adage of knowing your audience, if you will. It's knowing enough about the organization, the company, and the job that you're applying for to have a sense of whether that, that personal live connection is going to gain you significant benefit, some benefit, or no benefit. And you don't always know that. So I think err on the side of doing it more instead of less, especially as you are out there, you know, applying to multiple different places if you can. I will say doing that virtually can also have a lot of meaning and impact. And I work with a lot of folks who may be applying for entry-level or mid-level jobs in larger organizations as they come out of school or they're a few years out of school, and they have to do the online application. It's just part of the process. And any recruiter and any HR professional will tell you, as much as we love the personal connection and we love to kind of interact directly with our candidates, you got to do the online application because you got to get in our system. Having said that, if you can find a personal contact within that company who can help you navigate the application process, who might be able to connect you to the recruiter directly, who might be able to get your resume in front of the right person, that has value. And so that's where LinkedIn can be a great tool, just looking at your professional network in general, again, going back to the alumni network and, you know, trying to figure out who you might know in common, that can be really helpful. So in that sense, I would say absolutely that the live in-touch interaction can be useful.
I like that. You know what? To me, it's important. I think that it shows – you know, it shows somebody who's, first of all, as you said earlier, stepping out of your comfort zone. It shows that you know, you have a little chutzpah, right? That you
yep.
want to go out there and it gives you the opportunity to set yourself apart from everybody else. Oh, you know what? This is Bert Martinez. He's been bothering me all week long. He's called me. He's stopped by. You know, I don't know. He has the requirements, but you know, the guy's bugging me. No, I'm just kidding.
Right. Yeah, it definitely can be a differentiator, right? I mean, there are recruiters and HR professionals and hiring managers get hundreds and thousands of resumes for a single job often, depending on what it is and where it is. And absolutely, kind of demonstrating that you are an individual and not just an applicant number, and that you have particular different kind of qualifications and capabilities than perhaps everybody else on the radar, absolutely can help you secure the interview. And I think, you know, no harm done there. What I do think you have to think about, and this is particularly challenging for those of us who've not been in the professional world for very long, because we're just not experienced enough here with this to have gone through it enough times, know when to dial it back. So knowing that reaching out live or stopping by the office or the store once is really not a bad idea. 5 phone calls or, you know, 10 emails or 3 drive-bys in a week, maybe not so much. So you don't want to turn off a potential employer by extending yourself, but you also want to differentiate yourself by being the person who, to your point, has a little more chutzpah and a little more ambition, if you will.
Right. You go from promoting yourself to being a stalker.
Yeah, nobody likes a stalker bird.
No, absolutely. Well, these have been some great tips, Vicki. I appreciate you stopping by, and I would love to have you back next year and talk more about some HR tips, some ways to find your perfect job in the new year. Vicki Konchushenko, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing today.
Thanks very much. It's been a great opportunity.
All righty. Good stuff there from Vicki Konchushenko. I think I'm getting better. I'm not really sure. But a lot of great tips there on how to, you know, get through the whole process. Sometimes it's not easy. Most importantly, you just got to remember that you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.